is going to fly for Ricky Roberts, your winner.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Tom Corbett, along with Justin St. Louis, and this is Uncommon Deeds.
Oh, man, is it ever.
How's it going, buddy?
It's good. Is that going to stay in or no?
No.
Okay.
You know.
Then only you and I will know about it.
Yeah.
Jesus, that was funny.
I thought I'd get a nice pop out of you with that one. Whew. Anywho.
Yeah.
We are... on a nice little run here, a couple weeks in a row, which is always nice. Remember when we were at whatever it was, 80 straight. Now it feels like when we get that 2-3 in a row, we're like, yeah, on the run again.
Yeah.
On a run. Yeah. But
it's getting cold and everybody's kind of hunkered down right now. There's not a lot going on.
Yeah, that is true. And everyone's getting sick, my house included.
And mine.
Yeah.
You can hear it in my voice. Maybe. I don't know if you can. I can.
If you're listening to this, we're okay.
We're okay.
You can reach out to make sure. You can like. You can like this show and subscribe to make sure we're okay.
You know what? We really need the pick-me-up. Please like the show.
And while you're doing that, go ahead and throw a like on No Fouls. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Maybe New Sports Order.
Yeah. Maybe Uncommon Media.
And Uncommon Media. Four things to like.
You are working the Facebooks now.
What did we get, like 200 responses on that question?
It was a lot.
Your favorite driver? Let me look. Let me take a look. It's and they're still coming in. Like as we press record, my phone was like, and it's somebody said Stubb Vadden is their favorite driver. 233 comments on this.
Right on.
That's awesome. Thank you, everybody. I was bored Friday. I was at lunch and I was like, let's put something on the Facebook.
What was your favorite most obscure answer?
Somebody said Travis Pastrana today. Which is obviously not a obscure anything, but not expected. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Also, I would rank him in my top five. Now that I think about it.
I was very much, and it didn't happen because I'm a little lazy, and I just forgot about it and didn't go back and do it. But I was going to post a picture of your street stock car.
Mm.
No writing or anything. But A, I forgot. And B, I'm like, oh, Justin will probably delete that.
I wouldn't have deleted it, but I would have definitely made a smart-ass comment about you need to raise your standards. My favorite comment was, I'm a little biased, but for me it's definitely Nader Tater. And that was from Nader Tater. Yeah, that was good.
That is good. Speaking of, I don't want to say obscure because it's not the right word, but perhaps a name that isn't at the top of everyone's tongue when you think about kind of the 90s and late models and Thunder Road and White Mountain is today's guest.
Yeah. You know, and I always was interested in Billy Holbrook growing up because – really, he wasn't that much older than us. and he was out there in a late model and doing well. But he was never there long enough to really follow him. Does that make sense? I don't know. I mean, he ran one season here and one season there and one season here and then half a season somewhere else. And it was hard to keep up with him.
I kind of zoned out after you said not much older than us, as come on now. He graduated Hazen in 1989. And okay. While I look like I graduated in the early 90s, 2004.
I'm 01. So, I mean, he's okay. So he's 12 years older than us, which means when I'm 12, or when's he racing? Say 1996. So if I'm 13 years old, he's only 25. I mean, that's not that far off, right?
Well, I'm
that's,
10.
Okay, but that's still relatable. Like if we're watching TV at that time, the coolest guys in the world that we're watching on TV are 25.
Yeah, but I don't think I relate to them at 10 years old.
Well, I would relate to them more than like Dave Gibbs, you know, in his 50s or 60s, I guess. I don't know.
I'm not relating to Slater on Saved by the Bell.
No.
But I can appreciate it.
More of a Screech guy.
I don't know if that ages
character,
well.
Not the person. Yeah. It's a slippery slope. But anyway,
Don't Google.
Where the don't hell Google Blippi while you're at it either. Steezy Grossman, right? anyway, Billy Holbrook. He was Billy the Kid. I mean, it's just a cool, right? And the car looked good, and he was fast, and he came and he went. And we were just kind of wondering,
why?
You know, why? Where the hell did he go? And it wasn't intentional, but our last three episodes have just blended right together. You know, we got Steve Miller, and then we got to Pete Fecto, and Fecto's like, oh, I've been hanging out with Miller, you know, and I might drive his car. It's like, oh, that's cool. And then he says, oh, you know, my championship with ACT, I won with Billy Holbrook's car. And I was like, I've already talked to Billy Holbrook about being on the show. Let's do it now. So the whole thing just kind of, it was continuity. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sure.
And if you know, or you've seen the graphic for today's episode, you know that we did not get in contact with the number 92 that we had planned on for multiple goddang months.
Yeah, multiple goddang months. I will say I appreciate Jaden Perry reaching out to us.
And whoever reached out to him
whoever
to tell him we were looking for him.
We were playing the 92 car number game, and we got the message from Jaden the next morning after the show came out. That was funny. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that was good, too.
Right.
We could not do this show for you for free every single week without the help of our sponsors. Man, it was cold this morning. It was one of those I went to drop off Rowan at preschool, and he starts on the playground, and I'm standing there. I'm like, oh, it feels cold. And I think their rule is, at least with the preschool, is the real feel has to be 10 or above 10. Otherwise, they have to play inside. And it wasn't even dawning on me that it could be close to that. Then I open up my weather, and it like real feel was 9. But I was on the Weather Channel app. Like, they use AccuWeather. So I had to quickly download AccuWeather, and I brought that up, and the real feel for them was 11.
What the hell?
So he played outside. Yes, there was a 3-degree difference between the Weather Channel real feel and the AccuWeather real feel.
That's not what I'm what the helling. I'm like, what's the difference between 9 or 10 or 11? Who cares? It's freaking cold out.
You got to make the cutoff at some point, I guess.
I guess so.
The cutoff is hard 10. Line. The cutoff is 10. But
okay.
The point is, I don't have a point. No, it's getting freaking cold.
Sponsor plug.
We finally got a little bit of snow, which means if you were to lose your power, per se, it could be a very tough evening or multiple days without power. That's why you should go see Bushy's Generator Sales and Service.
Mm-hmm. As we record this on Monday night, my thing on my computer says 17 degrees in Bridport, and I believe it, and it's always windy here. And this house is 200 years old, and it's drafty as hell. And if the power was to go out, all of the heat that we've built up would escape through every crack that we have. So keeping the power on is really super important right now. And we need to, Tom, we need to get on this thing.
I think we might need a few more sponsors before I get my standalone generator, but it's definitely on my wish list. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that if you're in the market for one, you've got a budget, I think that it's affordable. We blow it on our wad on home improvements this year. I don't think we can afford one right now, but it's something that Linda and I have definitely talked about. And of course, our first call would be Ben. Whether he's part of our show or not, he's the number one guy in the state for Briggs & Stratton and Kohler generators. And he's good at what he does. So, I mean, that's all the push that you need. But yeah, do it. And we are thrilled that people have actually called Ben Bushy and become customers of Bushy's Generator Sales and Service because of this show. And we appreciate that. And you could be the next.
Speaking of blowing cash on home improvements, there is no better place to spend your hard-earned dollars to improve your home than Barry Tile.
You folks didn't hear it because it's been cut out, but the previous try on this ad was spectacular, and I wish that it had stayed in the show. But what Tom was going to say was accurate, as disgusting as it was. It was accurate. And if you got a ratty old carpet, you know, that you want to get rid of and spruce the place up, get some hardwood or a nice tile floor or something, and call the folks at Barry Tile, Morrison Clark, 50 years in the biz down in Barry, Vermont. And it's just gorgeous stuff. Take a look at their social media. You'll see it on Facebook. And it's really all the examples that you're ever going to need are right there.
The amount of years that they've put into it, the legacy that they've built, I think does the talking for itself. But sure, go on. Look at the products. Look at the work. And then if you're not sold, then, well, you have bad taste.
I almost did a spit take with my water on that one. it's true. countertops and showers and flooring, carpet, all of it. That's indoor, outdoor, home or business. They got you.
Yeah, and we're going to check it out in person in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot this Saturday, as we're recording something in the afternoon. Shh, we won't tell. They will.
It's not going to take too much for you to figure it out.
They'll tell you.
They'll tell you.
And then, of course, the weekend after is Christmas weekend, so probably won't be doing it then, but come beginning of 2023,
Yeah. We're
going to be Barry Tile boys.
Yeah.
Before,
it's crazy that we haven't been there yet.
It is. That just shows how little we've actually been able to kind of get out and travel comparative to what we thought we were going to be able to do.
The Pete Fecto show was like our 10th in person, maybe 12 total ever out of.
I feel like shows. That's high.
Is it? It might be. You might be right.
I feel like we've done like 6 or 7 maybe in person. But
yeah, I don't know.
We'll tally it up for another time.
Yeah.
But right now, it is time, after a just rousing open so far, for Justin to bring it home with story time.
This week's story time is kind of fun because it connects the past of short track stock car racing into the future. The new ASA Stars National Super Late Model Tour will debut in 2023, but it will have a very familiar look and feel. As with many things discussed on this podcast, the story begins in Waterbury, Vermont. Tom Curley, fresh off his firing from NASCAR, sitting alone in his office in the fall of 1985, decided to make wholesale changes, not only to his own racing program, but to the national short track landscape. In the wake of NASCAR's dissolution of the NASCAR North Tour, Curley took basically every element of that tour that he built under NASCAR and put a new name on it, the American Canadian Tour. As the end of the offseason approached in the spring of 1986, Curley had another announcement. In a year's time, he would be joining forces with two other promoters to form a new partnership called the Stock Car Connection and a national tour called the Great American Challenge Series. Curley's new ACT organization needed the 1986 season to transition out of the steel-bodied late models and into the fiberglass-bodied super late models and pro stocks run by Rex Robin of the Midwestern American Speed Association, or ASA, and Bob Harmon's Southern All-Pro Series. Their three pools of drivers would unite in a six-race series in 1987, held once a month, with two races in each promoter's home region. ACT scheduled a 300-lap race in May at the Saint-Hyacinthe Super Speedway Trioval in Quebec, about 45 minutes from Montreal, and Curley agreed to manage the first-ever event at the brand-new 1-mile, 5-turn oval at Pennsylvania International Raceway in Nazareth, the pride and joy of billionaire motorsports icon Roger Penske, 1 week before the CART IndyCar Series made its debut there in September. ASA territory claimed a 300-lapper at Queen City Speedway in Cincinnati, Ohio in June, and the famous Milwaukee Mile at the Wisconsin State Fairgrounds in August. All-Pro chose Alabama's Birmingham International Raceway in July, and the season-ending All-American 400 at the Nashville Fairgrounds in Tennessee in October. All six races were to be tape delay broadcasted to a national audience on the American Sports Cavalcade program on TNN. Full field race purses totaled about $100,000 per event, equivalent to more than $250,000 today. That's per race. And as impressive as that is, wait until you hear the entry list. The fledgling ACT offered up star drivers from the U.S. and Canada, Robbie Crouch, Beaver Dragon, Jean-Paul Cabana, Jamie Obi, Mike Berry, Mike Rowe, Claude Leclerc, Kevin LePage, Ricky Craven, on and on. The South was represented with all-pro stars including Jody Ridley, Bobby Gill, Mickey Gibbs, Steve Grissom, Daniel Keane, and Mike Harmon. And from the ASA came the heaviest of the heavy hitters, Dick Trickle, Mark Martin, Butch Miller, Joe Shear, Bob Seneker, Mike Eddy, Harold Fair, Tom Jones, Bobby Dotter, and young guns like Ted Musgrave and Kenny Wallace. There was so much hype around the series that model car maker Revell created an ASA-style Chevy Camaro model kit that featured Butch Miller, Bob Seneker, and part-time short tracker Darrell Waltrip. It even had Stock Car Connection, ASA, and ACT contingency decals in the kit. It's pretty wild. This series was a recipe for a slam dunk success, right? Well, it wasn't. The opener at Saint-Hyacinthe was plagued with low ticket sales and an ugly weather forecast, and so the grandstands weren't even half full. While this race was in ACT country on one of its staple tracks, and it drew a strong car count, remember that this was in May, and it was just the fourth race that the series had run with the new fiberglass bodies and the true super late model rules package, rules that ASA and all pro drivers had been familiar with for several years. As such, Butch Miller absolutely killed them all weekend, winning the 300-lapper from the pole, leading to a fairly ho-hum show. Miller was the most dominant big league short tracker in North America in the late 1980s, and his Saint-Hyacinthe win was worth an incredible $27,000, equivalent to about $70,000 in today's money. Ted Musgrave was second, Bobby Gill was third, and the best that ACT drivers could do was Jamie Obi's seventh place run. Tom Curley, who was not only in charge of the Stock Car Connection, but also held the lease on Saint-Hyacinthe and was the event's promoter, reported that he lost more than $100,000 that weekend. Within days, Bob Harmon pulled the plug on the event at Birmingham, even though it was more than 2 months away, hoping to avoid the loss that Curley had endured. Still, the new series pressed on. A ton of cars showed up at Cincinnati, but that race was a total bloodbath. The ASA group obliterated everyone in their own backyard. Butch Miller won again, beating Dick Trickle and Mark Martin. ASA drivers also swept time trials, both qualifying heats and the 50-lap showdown of champions, which was kind of a mini all-star race planned for the events. By the way, Bob Seneker won the showdown at Saint-Hyacinthe. The top finishing non-ASA driver in the 300 at Cincinnati was All-Pro's Bobby Gill, who finished 10th, two laps down. The best ACT finisher was Kevin LePage in 17th, nine laps down. The Midwest fans showed up, though, and the race was not a financial disaster, so it was on to Milwaukee in July. It was another big draw for the ASA field, but ACT didn't send very many quality cars, and only Jody Ridley and Steve Grissom made the trip north from All-Pro Land. Once again, Butch Miller ran the show, beating rookie Ted Musgrave and veteran Joe Shear to a $9,300 payday. It's about $25,000 today, in front of nearly 10,000 fans. Pretty good. ACT did find a bright spot with Maine's Mike Rowe, who was substituting for the ill Mike Berry, finishing fifth in the LeBurge Buick. Jamie Obie was ninth and Robbie Crouch was 11th, giving the ACT newbies a little bit of hope. Nazareth was next, and it was a turning point for the stock car connection. Not in a good way, either. Only 28 cars showed up for qualifying on Friday and Saturday, 14 of them from ACT, 12 from ASA, only Steve Grissom from All-Pro, and former Indianapolis 500 winner Danny Sullivan, who had a minority ownership stake in the track and was making an appearance to help build up the IndyCar race the next week. Despite being just 90 minutes from New York City, and with Nazareth being one of America's most well-known racing towns as the home of the Andretti's, the grandstands were virtually empty, and once again, poor weather was a major factor. Butch Miller beat Danny Sullivan in time trials on Friday and then won the first 25-lap heat race over Mike Rowe on Saturday after a delay of several hours due to rain. Rowe was the only ACT driver who was noteworthy in the qualifier, too, as the remaining five ACT drivers in that heat finished in the final five positions. And then in Heat 2, disaster struck. Beaver Dragon took the lead from Danny Sullivan on the first lap, but as the field entered turn three, seven-time ASA champion Mike Eddy made a move inside Sullivan. The two touched and all hell broke loose. Nine of the 14 cars in the heat race piled into each other and into the wall, bringing out the red flag. The track was completely blocked and it took 40 minutes for the safety crew to separate the damaged cars from each other. Before the race could restart, which only five cars were prepared to do, the rain returned. The balance of the heat race was scrapped, and with no laps complete, the running order at the time of the crash was determined to be the finish, and it set the starting field for Sunday. Thankfully, and it must be admitted that it was thankful, Mother Nature had other plans, and Sunday's 250-miler was a total washout. The race was canceled, and promoter Roger Penske made the unheard-of offer of giving each team $600 in tow money for their troubles. It was another disaster, and the second one in Tom Curley's ACT footprint. There was only one more shot at building momentum, but barring any weather issues, it was a virtual guarantee to be a smash hit with the All-American 400 at Nashville. And it was. Nashville's favorite son, Darrell Waltrip, showed up with the Tide colors from his NASCAR Winston Cup ride, and along with him came the likes of Bobby and Davey Allison, Rusty and Kenny Wallace, Sterling Marlin, and everybody who was anybody from all three of the Stock Car Connections Foundational Series, plus home track stars like Mike Alexander, Bobby Hamilton, Chad Chaffin, and David Green. Overall, Nashville turned out to be a great equalizer, with far more parity there than in the previous races. Darrell Waltrip won the race, but there was controversy from the outset as he dropped an 80-pound lead weight disguised as a radio, complete with fake knobs and an antenna, out of his car on the pace laps. Robbie Crouch remembers nearly running it over, and I've been told that former ACT technical inspector Stan Meserve has it in his possession. Butch Miller dominated most of the day before fading late. Mark Martin had the lead in hand with a handful of laps left, but a wreck and a restart with four laps left allowed Darrell Waltrip to catch and pass Martin on the last lap. The wind was beyond popular for old DW in front of his hometown crowd at the zenith of his success in NASCAR. According to multiple accounts of those who were there, even though tech officials knew that the car was illegal, they quickly conferred in private to determine that there was no way they could disqualify Waltrip without inciting a riot of angry Nashvillians, and so they looked the other way. Robbie Crouch finished a strong third and was a contender all day, which was also a bright spot. Nashville was a good way to end the year, but still, the offseason sent the three promoters home to lick their wounds from the year. The Stock Car Connection was wholly revamped for 1988. The schedule would start on the weekend of July 23rd and 24th at Sanair, move to New Hampshire's Lee USA Speedway on Wednesday night. Then there was a special six-car all-star race that was to be held Thursday night at Thunder Road in Vermont. And then on the weekend, it was off to the Cayuga Speedway in Ontario, which is more ASA territory than ACT. Nashville was the finale again, and that was it for the whole season. 1 week in July and 1 weekend in October. Butch Miller beat Junior Hanley at Sanair in front of a huge crowd, and Hanley was flying the ACT colors that year, so second place was pretty good. Ted Musgrave, Beaver Dragon, and Bob Seneca rounded out the top five. Ted Musgrave won at Lee, beating home track favorite Paul Richardson and ACT great Jean-Paul Cabana. Butch Miller won the 20-lap shootout at Thunder Road on Thursday night and pocketed a cool $2,500 for his efforts, and then he admitted to the crowd that he hated the place, he hated the wall, and he drove scared the whole time he was out there. Paul Richardson was second, followed by Robbie Crouch, Dick Trickle, Bobby Gill, and Ricky Craven. Trickle took the win at Cayuga ahead of Harold Fair and Ted Musgrave, with ACT rookie and former ASA star Russ Erlin in eighth place. Miller got his All-American 400 win in October, beating Harold Fair, Scott Hansen, All-Pros Darrell Brown, and Junior Hanley. But the magic was gone. The Stock Car Connection was a grand concept with a lot of initial supporters, but the general feeling was that the series demanded too much time away from home and work for grassroots racers. Between travel and a three-day race weekend, teams were spending five or more days on the road. The money was pretty good, but it proved to be unsustainable for the promoters. Now, fast forward to 2023, and the new Stars National Tour has been created to bring together the CRA Super Series, the ARCA Midwest Tour, and the Southern Super Series under the guidance of top Illinois promoter Bob Sargent and his Track Enterprises organization. A 10-race schedule has been released, and the ASA name has even been brought back from the dead through a licensing deal with its new owner, which is NASCAR. Will a national super late model tour work? It's been 35 years since the last one was tried, unless you count Tom Mayberry's past national championship efforts in the 2000s, which they did have a bit of merit to them. Whether it was successful or not, the Stock Car Connection was an incredible effort and proved to be ahead of its time. Let's hope for success this time around. Our guest this week was one of the young, up-and-coming hard chargers in the 1990s. And it depended on the year where you saw him, because he bounced around to a bunch of different places, but he was successful at just about all of them. And he was exciting to watch. And then he was gone. So we've been kind of curious to see what he's been doing these last 25 or so years. And it's a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show. Billy Holbrook, welcome to Uncommon Deeds.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome to be here. I appreciate it.
Well, we usually kind of kick this off the same way every week. And that is, when do you remember motorsports coming into your life?
Oh, motorsports was in my life pretty much my whole life. My father always raced growing up. We always had a race car in the yard. And as I got into my teen years, got involved with the driving part of it, built a street stocker. And once my father saw potential in my driving, he got out of the late model and put me in his late model. So pretty much grew up with it.
Now, I did a little research here before we started, and did you grow up in Florida? I see that your father was racing down there.
Yes, I come from Maine originally. My father had a job that we traveled a lot. So we were all up and down the East Coast, and I always had a race car behind the pickup. But yeah, my father raced all up and down the East Coast. I remember him winning races at East Bay Raceway and Florida, Tampa, Florida, between Tampa and St. Pete. So I got a lot of fond memories of racing through my father, and it was definitely my father that got us got me involved in my whole family, actually.
And what was your dad primarily racing?
He raced a little bit of dirt, asphalt. He raced up in Maine a lot, Oxford Plains, all the Immunity Raceway, all them tracks up there. And then, like I said, we raced all up and down the East Coast, some in the Carolinas and down in Florida. But he raced mostly late models, pretty much late models that I can remember.
So he was pretty good then. He was winning races and stuff.
He had some success for sure. The biggest race I remember was at East Bay in Tampa, Florida, when I was probably 7-8 years old. That was the biggest race that I can remember him winning, which was pretty exciting at the time.
So if he's racing late models at East Bay and, you know, stuff like that, I mean, is he racing like CJ Rayburn and those guys? I mean, is this like wedge stuff and crazy superpower, crazy late models?
No, not quite like that. They're more of a, I don't really want to say a street stock late model, but it weren't kind of like Bloomquist or any of that type of late model. Gotcha.
More homegrown.
Yeah, more homegrown. Yeah. Right, full stuff, exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a pretty cool upbringing to, you know, not be in one spot and still be racing and see kind of the motorsports world, right?
Yeah, it was. We see all kinds of different tracks, well, different parts of the country growing up. We see, I see a lot of different schools because I was young, which was kind of tough at times. But yeah, then we ended up here in Vermont back in the early 80s, where my parents decided to settle down. And this is kind of where we called home from 84 Then my father started racing at Riverside in Groveton. He did that for a year or two. Then I, like I said, I got involved, built a street stocker, and then went to Groveton and raced also. And then, like I said, he saw potential in my driving, put me in his late model, and he never got back in a car again after that. Kind of neat in a way how it all worked out.
So you mentioned built a street stock. Were you always kind of turning wrenches coming up?
Yeah, I helped my dad as a kid a little bit on the race cars. My brothers did also, Shane and Sean, my older brothers. But yes, the street stock I built, pretty much built it, me and some buddies with a little help from my father. And then went out and got some sponsors and literally tore the car apart, built it as a kid. I think I was 16. I think I was about 16 years old when I built my first street stock. And I didn't even, if I remember right, I didn't even finish the season with the street stock. I got in the late model a few months in, I guess, that racing season. That would have been like 1989, if I remember right.
I know that there's some Holbrooks up at Grovetona. They've been there forever. Are they part of your family, or is it just coincidence?
Yeah, just coincidence. Know them all myself. Knew Gary and Willie and that whole bunch. Got to know them back in them days, racing down there. Got to know the mom and the whole crew. But no relation. But to look at Gary and my father, you'd almost think there was a relation there. But there weren't.
To transition to a late model 2 months in to your racing career, are you nervous to make that switch? Are you kind of a kid that's, no offense, too dumb to realize, holy shit, this is a big deal?
Probably a little bit of both, to be honest. Yes, I was definitely nervous, but excited at the same time. I was doing pretty well in the street stock at the time, so I was anxious to get into something with a little more horsepower and a little wider tires and a little better handling type cars where I could maybe show a little more talent. And it all worked out. I ended up getting rookie of the year in the late model. Actually won my first race, not at Groveton, but we went down to Hudson with that same car and won my first feature down at Hudson Speedway. I think it was that year or the following year. So had some fairly good success right off the bat, in the late model. So my father was quite impressed, and he devoted all his time, a lot of money, a lot of effort to build us some really nice cars back in the day. And he was really good at turning wrenches, and he knew how to set the cars up. I could come in and tell him what it was doing, and he could make the adjustments and go back out. And I was just dumb enough to push it a little faster, a little further, and it worked out. Worked out quite often for us.
Who are you racing with while you're getting your feet wet?
Oh, back in them days would have been Stacy Cahoon, Randy Potter, George Stone. Yeah, a lot of them old veterans.
Aaron Bennett was winning a lot back then.
Exactly. Aaron Bennett was winning a lot back then. A lot of them veterans, they had been there for years before we even showed up there. So Gary Holbrook was actually racing back then. I'm trying to think of a few more names, but that's quite a fleet of late models back in them days at Groveton.
Now, were you kind of a spitfire, or were you reserved, or how did it go? I mean, were you ruffling fenders right from the get-go, or how were you received?
I was known to be aggressive. Yeah, I would say I was aggressive. Most people would probably tell you that. My father would tell me to slow down and take it a little easy at times. But it was hard for me. Like I said, I was a kid, and yeah, I probably should have slowed down sometimes more than I did. But that was me. That was just how I was wired.
Yeah, you mentioned some, let's say, big personalities. So I would assume if you're going in there and you're getting after it, you could, you know, ruffle some feathers with a guy like a Randy Potter.
Sounds like there's some stories there.
Yeah. We, Randy Potter and I definitely got into it a few times. I remember getting into it with Randy. I believe he spun. I was going for, I don't know, I might have passed him for a second, I think, one night. Maybe might have even been in the lead. And I got taken out by Randy, whether it was an accident or not. But that kind of pissed me off. So I ended up putting him in the fence, and it caused a big ruckus. And it was quite a night, for sure. But, yeah, I definitely ruffled some feathers at times.
Well, now, to be fair, we had Randy on the show about a year ago, and he said there was one year he won the championship, and the next year he was told, don't come back, and don't come back next year either. So it's not, he must not have been, you know, it's kind of maybe two hard-headed kids going at it, right?
Not a choir ball.
That's probably that's exactly what it was. We were both hard-headed kids. We butt heads, and that happened quite often with a couple front runners, as you guys know. So it was, all said and done, if we were to meet up today, we'd probably be good friends and drink beer together, you know? Yeah, but definitely butted heads for sure.
Is that kind of the impetus for moving around to different tracks? I mean, you said, and I saw it too, that you won at Hudson in 1990, right, which is not close to Groveton at all. So were you kind of feeling like maybe we should do something else, or were you racing both tracks at once, or?
Yeah. Actually, we went down to Hudson maybe just a handful of times. My father was one to we traveled around. I mean, I raced up to Oxford. We raced all over New England. We went out to Malone, Plattsburgh, obviously Thunder Road. So we didn't stay in one place very often. I can remember only racing, to be honest, one full season at Thunder Road, and two full seasons at White Mountain. Other than that, we bounced around. Some years we had two cars, a pro stock and a late model. So we would be racing Oxford, say, on a Friday night and drive all the way back to Greensboro, load the other car and go to Plattsburgh with the late model or somewhere else. So we did a lot of racing, different tracks. But yeah, as far as settling down at one track, we only did that like for a few years, which I kind of wish we would have stayed at like Thunder Road for a full season, I should say, or another full season other than the one the only one we did. I think I'd have had a little more success down there also if we would have stayed there a little longer and did a few more seasons. Almost think I might have been a champion at Thunder Road if we would have stuck around. But my dad was one to want to travel and race about anywhere where we could.
I saw an article that I think Dave Morse wrote, our old buddy, and there was a picture of Milt Wright's car up on jack stands in your shop. And
yep.
I mean, you're only a year into your driving at this point, and then you're going whole hog racing, you know, with a tour at Airborne at 17 years old or whatever. And then racing Oxford weekly the next year against like friggin' Mike Rowe and Tracy Gordon.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's putting your feet to the fire.
Oh, it sure was. I got a lot of experience. I learned a lot them years, especially racing at Oxford. We had minimum success up there. We ran pretty well every week, but just couldn't get the breaks up there at Oxford. But it was a great learning curve for me. Once I got back to some of these quarter mile tracks and stuff like that, it seemed like the cars were a little slower. They were a little easier to maneuver. So, I mean, I got a lot of great experience at them bigger tracks, which really helped me once I got back to the tracks like Thunder Road, you know, White Mountain, say, had a lot of success there. So, yeah, I mean, bouncing around did help me, especially on these bigger tracks, to be a little smoother, I guess, on the quarter miles and stuff once we went back to the quarter mile tracks.
Could you talk to any of the guys you were racing with when you were trying to learn and hitting different tracks, or was it just kind of you and your dad trying to figure it out?
Yeah, it was pretty much my dad, myself, and my crew trying to figure it out as we went. My dad was pretty much my mentor, so if I needed, advice or whatever, dad was pretty much there to give it to me. He was the guy I went to. He was pretty much my racing hero, per se.
What was his reputation when he was a racer, and like, did that carry over to helping you get off the ground? Because you raced at tracks that he had raced at years before.
Right. Dad had a great reputation with people. He was a pretty easygoing guy most of the time. But I think a lot of my racing skills or personality, if you want to say that, come from my father. He was a great guy for sure. Everyone loved him, and he was pretty aggressive on the track, but not overly aggressive where he got in a lot of mischief, I should say.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So if you're kind of the nomads on the scene, constantly wandering and going to different places, what made you say, okay, let's settle down and do a year at Thunder Road?
That's a good question.
Yeah, or any track, any year, really. Why? That's a really interesting path that you took.
Yeah, good question. I think the main reason is that I wanted to run for a championship. I wanted to get one of them. So that was our main reason. I raced the year at Thunder Road, ended up getting Rookie of the Year. Got a bunch of seconds. I think I got most popular driver or favorite driver that year also. So I wanted to settle down at one track so I could try to win a championship. That was my goal. And my father wanted a championship also, and my crew. So that was our main reason for settling down at one track. We just got to a point where, hey, I'd like to get a championship. We're going to run all these races and do things. Let's see if we can get a championship. And we did end up getting one at White Mountain in 1995. Should have had it in 1994 also, but won the very last race. All I had to do was finish it, and I broke the camshaft in 1994. So I lost the championship that year, but came back the following year and won it with 7 or 8 wins, a bunch of seconds. And I think like in the month of September, we won every race that month in that year. So we dominated that year at White Mountain. That was probably one of the highlights of my career.
So if you're the wanderer and you decide, okay, I'm going to come in here, and I'm coming in here, quote unquote, as a rookie, but I'm here for championships, how were you taken in by, you know, the Chuck Beatties, the Jim Sillies, the Thunder Road diehards that are there year in, year out when this young kid comes in with championship expectations?
Yeah, we butted heads. We butted head with a handful of them. Dwayne Lanfear for one. Actually, Dwayne, we butted Joey LeCaire. We butted head with quite a few of them, and they didn't really, I don't think they took to us very well coming in, knowing we had some success in other tracks and stuff. But we ended up fitting in pretty good, I believe, after they got to know us and everything. I think we fit in pretty well after a while. We did make a lot of friends down at Thunder Road, White Mountain, but we probably made some enemies too along the way. But I feel that's what happens when you run up front and you're gonna have incidents where you're gonna probably irritate some people, which we did. I was like I said, I was a little aggressive.
Did your age sort of form your reputation in the eyes of other people? Like, oh, here's this kid with, you know, this big money late model or whatever, and he comes in for 1 year. And he's trying to win our race, like, you know, Dwayne and Joey and those guys, they've been there for 40 years. And you come in for 1 year. I mean, was there sort of a chip on their shoulder? Like, this is our track and who the hell are you?
Yeah, I felt that for sure. I think a lot of them, because of the time I was a kid, I was still in high school at when I first started out, but I think they thought I was a spoiled rich kid, to be honest. My father always had nice equipment. We always had stuff built by Steve Levitt, had engines built by Andy Costello. We always had nice stuff, nice haulers. So I think I got perceived as a rich spoiled brat, to be honest, at the beginning until people got to know us. But I think that was our first initiative, first impression, maybe.
Were there anybody else kind of in your area that was making those drives kind of with you? I know there's been a lot of Hardwick, Greensboro guys throughout the years, a lot in the street stocks. If you're 17, are you getting anybody else kind of in the racing scene?
As far as like my crew, you're asking?
Fellow drivers.
Boy, off the top of my head, no, I don't believe so. I mean, back in them days, most of the ones were from my era. Well, we had like Guy Brown with a street stock. I had Milt Wright was a tour driver. But other than that, that's about all I can think of right now, top of my head.
Billy, I'm interested in what the promoters thought of you as a young kid when there weren't a lot of young kids in the early 90s racing at the top levels. And I'm talking not just Tom Curley, but, you know, Mike Liberty up at Oxford, who's got the world by the ass at that time.
Right. Right. Actually, I think they all liked it when we came to their tracks because I was young and was doing pretty well. So I think they liked it, the promoters. I mean, I know Tom Curley liked us there. But yeah, most places we went, as far as the promoters, they seemed very welcoming towards us.
What's it like for you guys when a brand new racetrack opens up in your backyard, like White Mountain in 1993?
Oh, that's pretty exciting for us. My father went down and checked it out before I even see it and came back and said, we're going to go down and race that place. It's a beautiful facility, a beautiful track. So yeah, we built the car for there and went down and right out of the box, the car was fast, started winning races right from day one down there. Actually, had one of my most scariest crashes down there, ended up going through the fence. That was pretty exciting and something I'll never forget. But yeah, White Mountain was very good to us.
Yeah, tell us about that wreck. It was like one of the very first races that they had there.
Yes, it was. Yep, and it was like the
I saw one picture, and it looks like you are about to land in the pit stands.
Yeah. I think it was the second week, maybe the second week of racing there. Second or third. It was pretty fresh. I started seventh. I went up and took the lead on, I don't know, 10th, 12th lap, whatever it was. I lapped everyone but the seventh car. My crew chief, Scotty Allen, was telling me to slow down. You got it in the bag, just slow down. And me being a kid, I wanted to lap the field. Never had done that. And I went up beside Tracy Bellrose going into turn three. And I'm not sure what happened, but we came together and pulled my steering linkage apart and just shot me right straight. Right off the track, I hit the bank, and the bank was launched me just like a ramp. Say
there wasn't a wall back then, right?
Oh, the following week there was. No, there weren't a wall. It was still. I mean, I think they just redid that, just built that bank, to be honest. But yeah, I landed 18 inches from the hot dog stand in the picture. You can see people under the car. One guy went up over the car. I think I broke a hip off. I think I broke a guy's hip and maybe an ankle of another fella, but to be honest, I should have killed somebody. So yeah, that shut the track down for the day. So I was leading the race and I didn't get the win either.
no.
Because, yeah, I was a little bummed about that, but no one got killed. I was a little bruised up. The car got hurt pretty good, but we ended up rebuilding it that week and came back the following week and won the race. So it was quite a week. It was a long week, but it paid off for us.
As a, 20-year-old at the time, and you have that wreck, and people are hurt.
Yep.
Is there any nerves the next week when you come back and climb back in?
No, I don't believe there was. I was I was still pretty banged up myself. I had some bruises and stuff like that, but no, I weren't nervous. I was probably anxious to get back in the car, to be honest.
I don't want to spend the whole episode on that wreck, but did you talk to the people that got hurt, or did they approach you at any point after, or, you know?
Yeah, I ended up talking to them a week or two later. I don't think it was the following week because they didn't make it back to the track, but it was a week. It was a two or three weeks later. They approached me at the track, and we had a pretty cool conversation about the whole incident. They thought it was, and of course it was, but they thought it was pretty scary. And I can just imagine it was pretty scary from my seat also.
Yeah.
I'm curious, not to sidetrack, but you mentioned your dad did dirt and asphalt. Did you ever have any aspirations to really try dirt?
I would have loved to have tried dirt. I never got an opportunity to, but I never ended up racing anything on dirt, which I kind of regret that now, because I think it would have been fun for one, but I would have liked to have at least had the experience of racing on some dirt, especially seeing my dad did. But I never did get the opportunity. We always stuck with the asphalt stuff.
Never too late, as we've heard with our last few guests and Steve Miller, and he's trying to get Pete Fecto out of retirement. So.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that about Steve Miller, but who knows, right?
Well, Tom Glazer is, he hasn't been in a race car in 40 years, and he was trying to get into one, so it's never too late, right?
No, I mean, I would love to get back into one. I really would. I believe I still got it in me. It's just if someone offered me a ride, I would definitely give it a shot for sure.
Hmm. Well, what the hell's stopping you?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I should go out and push it a little more.
See, there you go. All right. So let's talk about your championship then, which is a couple years later. And, you know, like you said, you dominated that year. I don't have all the records, but it you kind of have to stop counting after a while of how many wins you got, because it's a little boring. You know, you killed them that year.
Yeah, we did. We had a phenomenal car, and everything just, I mean, it was just one of them years where the luck was on our side. The car was spot on every week. And of course we weren't wrecking a lot, so we weren't working on the car a whole lot, which makes it nice. You're not burnt out every week by just working on the cars. It was just a phenomenal year. And I think that was the only year we really broke even as far as money wise, in racing. Because we didn't wreck a lot, we won a lot. I got a lot of seconds. So yeah, probably the best that year at White Mountain was probably the best successful year we had in racing.
What's it like racing for Donnie and Terry Avery as promoters?
Yeah, they were good. Yeah, they were awesome. They treated us pretty decent. And they were learning too at that time. You know, trying to learn the business. But all in all, they're good people. The family was good. Got to know the kids, got to know Terry and Donnie and the whole crew. So we had a good time with them for sure.
Were the fans at White Mountain? I mean, because that was kind of your longest stretch of any track that you ran, was like, what, 2 or 3 years. But did the fans have time to like get to know you and, you know, cheer for you or get to know you and boo you? Or how did that go for you?
We had probably a 50-50 deal there. We won often, so a lot of the fans, you know how it works. A lot of the fans didn't really care for that after a while. So we got a lot of cheers and a lot of boos, for sure. But it was pretty exciting times for us. As far as the boos, it was like John Paul Cabana said, you know, you might boo me, some might cheer me, but you all know me, type of thing. So it was kind of cool.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
All kind of moves forward in 96, you get arguably probably your biggest win at Thunder Road, ACT Coca-Cola Firecracker. Tell us a little bit about that day.
Yeah. Oh, that was huge. Yeah. I still, I probably think of that every day. That was the biggest win of my career for sure. The car was on a rail that night. I don't think there was anyone there that was going to stop us that night. We qualified well. We raced well, and we ended up winning the race. And I'll tell you, that was one of the only times I see my father cry in the winner's circle. He was so proud because we all know how hard it is to win at Thunder Road. So it was very an emotional night for us to win that race, especially with all the cars that came and qualified for it and everything. And we weren't even a weekly runner there. We just kind of poked our head in, if I remember right, and it worked out for us.
Yeah, that was, I do remember that race as a kid. And of course, that's now an ACT win. But at the time, yeah. ACT was gone. That was the first year that.
Right. That would have been a tour win today.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, at that time, it's sort of uncertain what's going to happen, right? And
right.
You've got this big win and some momentum. What were your, mm-hmm. what were your plans? I mean, did that win change your trajectory? Because you ended up back at Thunder Road the next couple of years.
Yeah. I think it did actually. Knowing that we could go down Thunder Road and win. I mean, we've got a bunch of seconds down there and stuff before, but to win down there, and then of course that's very gratifying, and to win, it was like, you know, we want to come back and do this again. So I think it did change things a little bit. We might have settled down a little more after that and raced Thunder Road a little more frequent after that win.
But at the time, you were also dabbling again in pro stocks. You went back up to Oxford in 97 to start the year, and you started with the NEPSA Tour.
Yep, we did some NEPSA racing too. Yep, that's right.
So you're balancing two different things at the same time, right? Am I correct on that, or was
no? We had two cars going there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. So yeah, we were racing and working on the cars a lot, and plus I had a 40-hour-week job on top of that. So we were busy, and we were traveling. I mean, we were going to Oxford, and we were putting some miles on the haulers just to get to the races. I mean, we'd be in Oxford next week, we'd be in Malone, you know. So we did some traveling. So what was I going to say? We did a lot of work and traveling, yeah, for sure.
Do you think that took away at all at an opportunity on one side or the other, doing both rather than just trying to focus in on one?
Yeah, it probably did, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, if I was to do it all over again, I'd probably concentrate more on one place, because at the time too, I was driving and hoping maybe to get a Busch North ride, things like that, where maybe if we would have stayed in one place and had a little more success, that might have come to fruition also. But yeah, I think it might have a little bit.
You guys, from the perspective that, you know, we would have had in the grandstands, you seemed well-financed.
Yeah.
Was that true?
Yeah, we were well-financed. My dad had a pretty successful business. We pretty much had everything we needed, plus some. We had quality cars, quality motors. Pretty much the cars were top notch for sure. Most, I think anybody would probably tell you that. Peter Pecto would. He bought all our stuff when we got out of it.
Yeah. That's right. It's weird how our last three or four episodes have kind of all melted together. I guess, would you have been able to do your own Busch North program, or were you hoping to bring your helmet and a checkbook?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was hoping. I was hoping where my dad too, and my parents and my could just maybe come and watch someday. I was hoping maybe to get a ride for a Busch owner, Busch team,
Griswold, then, or somebody, right?
Yeah, someone kind of local. God, I'm trying to think, Quentin Bovair, someone like that, you know, with good financing. That was kind of my goal at the time.
And eventually you kind of came full circle, and 98 started the year back at Riverside doing the weekly late models.
Yep. Ended up winning some races there also. I can't remember if we ended up, I don't believe we finished the season there. I think we did some bouncing around again, but we did did end up winning some races that year. I think I got the track record that year. Had some success that year also. I think we got a few seconds, and yeah, we had a good year that year at Thunder Road. Or I'm sorry, at Riverside.
Well, but you did come back to Thunder Road too. That year as well.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, we bounced around, and I think we did fairly well at Thunder Road that year. I might have got some seconds, and can't quite remember now. It's quite a few years ago, but I remember having some success that year for sure.
So those last couple years, especially, and don't take this as a knock against you because I get it. But were you guys easily frustrated and just pulling up stakes because you weren't even completing seasons, let alone bouncing from track to track year to year? You were running two or three different programs at the same calendar year.
Yeah. Towards the end, I'll be honest, I was getting a little burnt out and wanted to do some other things. I mean, I was missing out on a lot of different things personally that I wanted to do because I was young when I started, and I was missing out on a lot. So towards the end there, we did take some weekends off where we were doing some different family things or other things other than racing for sure.
So at that point, are you already thinking that you see a break coming?
Yeah, I think I was. Yeah, I was really starting to get burned out. Like I said, we were racing two cars. We were traveling a lot, racing, and also working a 40-hour-week job. So some of the weeks when you wreck them, you work all night on them also. So yeah, I was starting to get burned out towards the end for sure.
Did you envision the break lasting, what's it been, 25 years?
Yeah.
or were you thinking like, we'll stop for a couple of years and come back to it?
No, when I got done, I was thinking I was done. Really? Yeah. I was thinking and I've been done too. I haven't been to a race until this year. My brother Sean talked me into going to Thunder Road this year. And that was the first, I went there twice this year. And that was the first time I went to a track since I crashed out on my last Milk Bowl.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. So I got to be honest, though, when I went back, brought back a lot of memories, a lot of emotions, all kinds of great memories. The smell, the atmosphere, the whole deal. It all just came back, and I'm sure I'll go back more this summer. To be honest, it was very exciting to be down there again, to see the people, see the cars. And I hadn't been to Thunder Road since they've redone it all, since the new owners and stuff. So it was really nice to go down and see all that and see a lot of friends and fans that I hadn't seen in years. So it was really, really cool for me to do that.
I bet. That's crazy. You think about last week, we talked about Pete Fecto starting his career at 40, and you're sitting there at 25, 26, knowing, I think I've had enough and I'm ready to retire.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd been racing for all 12 years or so at that time. So, yeah, it is kind of weird. But, again, I started young. I was back then, I think we mentioned it, though, back then there was no kids racing. And that's how I got the nickname Dave Moody pinned it on me, Billy the Kid, because I was the youngest. Every track we went to, I was the youngest one out there racing, especially in late models.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's always a kid with a beater in the street stock divisions or whatever, but there's, especially at that time, nobody your age running in the top levels.
But yeah, exciting times for me for sure.
If you've got a home project going on, your first stop should be Barry Tile and Morrison Clark Incorporated. From flooring to kitchens, from bathrooms to outdoor projects, from your home to your business, they are number one in Central Vermont.
As you've heard on this show, Justin and I are officially middle-aged super dads now. And one of our favorite hobbies is looking at the Barry Tile Facebook page to see their latest projects. I love the carpeting and hardwood flooring, and he loves the kitchen countertops and shower installations.
And it's true. Barry Tile has been family-owned for 50 years, and their experience shows in every single job. It's high-quality work by highly qualified people who can design and install everything you need to upgrade your home or office. It's not a big chain store. It's local people with common sense and a ton of skill.
Be like us and check out the Barry Tile Facebook page to see some examples of their incredible work. Or you can give them a call at 802-476-0912. You can also stop into the showroom at 889 South Barry Road in Barry, Vermont, and tell them that the guys from Uncommon Deeds sent you.
It's almost here. Winter is coming, and at least one New England snowstorm is going to knock your power out. When that happens and you're in the dark, you'll be wishing that you had called Bushy's Generator Sales and Service. So don't wait. Bushy's has been recognized as the number one dealer of Briggs & Stratton home standby generators in the state of Vermont, and they're also a leading dealer of Kohler generators. From sales and installation to service and maintenance on all makes and models of generators, from 10 kilowatts to 200, Bushy's is the only call you need to make. And hey, racers, you know how important it is to have small portable generators at the track, and Bushy's has you covered there too. After all, they're racers too, and they know what you're looking for. Check out their selection of Briggs & Stratton inverters and have the power where you need it, when you need it. Wayne and Ben Bushy have more than a decade's experience in this business, and Bushy's Generator Sales and Service covers all of Vermont and Hampshire, as well as Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York. Give them a call at 802-591-1903 or visit their Facebook page or bushysgenerator.com. Bushy's Generator Sales and Service of Springfield and Brookfield, Vermont. We keep your power on. And now, back to our show. So what did you think of the place when you walked into Thunder Road for the first time, and however long it had been?
Yeah, it was really cool. Like I said, it brought back a lot of emotions. I pictured my dad down there in the winner's circle. All kinds of stuff came back, to be honest. And then I got to smell the fuel and all that and hear the cars again. It was like, man, I think I'd like to get back into this again.
Did you go through the pits and kind of peek around at what's going on?
No, I didn't do that. I went down by the hot dog stand though and took a peek and stuff in there and waved to a couple of the old friends that were walking by and stuff. But I'll be honest though, maybe this upcoming season I might take a stroll through the pits and bring back some of them memories also.
How old are you now?
I just turned 52.
Well, see, yeah, you got plenty of time.
Yeah, right. If I can talk my wife into it, we'll be doing it again.
Well, we've learned that it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. So,
yeah. Okay. She's sitting right here. So,
we said it. He didn't.
Yeah, right.
And if she's listening, Justin St. Louis said it, not Tom Corbin.
Not Tom Corbin. Okay. That's right.
Yeah, awesome.
Give us a couple of memories of races that stand out. You know, now that we've gone through the career timeline, let's talk about specific memories. Give us a bad one first.
Bad one. Well, probably the bad one was the big wreck in 91, I guess. Yeah, that was probably the worst one. Other than that, I really didn't have too many. I had one bad wreck up in Oxford that they actually had to cut me out of the car for that. Yeah. That was a pretty nasty one too. And to tell you that story, the year before I broke my neck in a crash. It weren't a racing incident. It was just a regular car crash. Then we went to Oxford that following year, and I got in a bad crash up there, and they had to cut me out of the car because they thought that I broke my neck again. So that was pretty hairy. That was one of the bad ones. As far as good memories, I'm going to go back to the Coca-Cola 144. That was just so exciting for the whole family and my father and my crew and Scotty and my brother Sean and Shane and my mom, the whole deal. It was a pretty exciting night for us that night, just because it's pretty prestigious to win at Thunder Road for one, and to win that race for us was a really big deal for us for sure.
Some of our favorite stories are before or after the race. Kind of give us your best road trip story of maybe things that didn't go right on a road trip.
Oh, God, that's a good one. I'd have to think on that one, I guess. There's probably 100 of them I could tell you if I could think of them. But I do remember we did a lot of camping and stuff after the races and made a lot of new friends, and them were always good times. We did a lot of camping at these weekend events and stuff like that. So I can say that was that was a highlight too, of meeting a lot of the fans. They'd all come to the camper, and back then we were having a lot of success. So it was, then were really fun times also after the race, where you could actually relax, have a couple beers and have just let your hair down and have a good time, I should say.
Do you have any races that stand out where you weren't even a contender for the win, but you know, you drive from, you know, 30th to 7th or something like that, and it's a hell of a race. I mean, I remember those races that I ran more than anything that I won, you know.
We did a pro stock race in at White Mountain, and started dead last, and I ended up beating Dick Trickle out for a second. I didn't win the race, but that was a highlight for me, because I did. Dick Trickle ended up getting third, and I beat him out on the last lap to get second. And I'll tell you a little quick story. I was following Dick Trickle up through the field, and I won't forget this. And I'm sure there's been a million people that have seen this over the years with him, but he flipped a cigarette out of his window net as we were doing 90 down the backstretch. So that's kind of a highlight of mine also. Dick Trickle flicked a cigarette out while I was behind him.
I was going to ask. Not a lot of time to do that at White Mountain either.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I know. I mean, I was sweating, both hands on the wheel, and he's flicking cigarettes out. So pretty cool. Yeah.
I was going to ask if you learned anything following him up through, but I don't know if that's what you want to learn.
Yeah, right. No, I never took up smoking. But no, I ended up beating him on the last lap and got second, and that was a highlight of my career also. I can say I beat Dick Trickle.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
I think that I did find a little article on that. Joey LeCaire won that race, and you were
second. Yes, and now you say that, I think Joey did win that race. Yes. Yep.
So you know, you guys, and again, this is the first year of White Mountain, and they bring in Dick Trickle, who, my God, he's amazing. And everybody who's a short track fan knows that it doesn't matter that he didn't win any cup races. He was the man.
Yeah, he was the man, especially short track racing. He was
so,
the man.
So to bring him into a brand new track and have, you know, the old veteran Joey LeCaire and the young kid Billy Holbrook beat him on their own turf, how were the fans that night?
Oh, well, the fans are a little disappointed, because if I remember right, Dick Trickle didn't even come to the winner's circle. So a lot of the fans are very disappointed in Dick Trickle that night. He never came, never took pictures with us or anything like that. He sailed right off the racetrack and left. Yeah. So a lot of fans are very disappointed in him that night. I was hoping to get a picture with him at least, but that didn't happen either.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was. I think he was driving. I mean, he was driving a car, if I remember right, high school kids built. If I remember the story right. So I mean, he did pretty well in the car. But yeah, he never
like a tech program or something.
Yeah, I believe it was a tech program, if I remember right. Yeah, that built the car for him for that race. But yeah, he never come to the winner's circle top three, and he drove right off. So he never got pictures, and the fans didn't get to see him either, other than the introductions.
No kidding. Huh? Well, he had a rule that for every 100 laps that he ran, he needed an hour of sleep the night before. So he had probably a cup race allowed the next day and needed to go.
He was headed allowed the next day, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that was one of my highlights for sure.
What do you have a home track? I mean, if you were to pinpoint one, is it Groveton or is it Oxford or is it Thunder Road or White Mountain or where is it?
I guess if I had to say my home track, I'd probably say White Mountain, just because we raced at White Mountain probably more than anywhere, had probably had more success there than anywhere. I mean, it would be a toss up to me, probably White Mountain or Thunder Road. I mean, we did race some at Groveton, but I would say White Mountain or Thunder Road, I would consider a home track for me. Even though Thunder Road is just down the road from me, we race more at White Mountain.
Did you enjoy running the milk bowls in that format?
I did. Yeah, I did enjoy that. Yeah, we had a chance to win it once or twice. Never. Never did. The last race I ran in was the Milt Bowl, and I was in contention that day to win the race and ended up crashing out. I can't remember who I come in contact with. It was I can't remember his name. He was from St. John, LeJean, Kendall LeJean. Come in contact. I think I might have come down on him that day, and he spun me out. I think it was my fault, and ended up wrecking my car. And that was the last race I was in. I took the walk of shame from turn three at Thunder Road all the way back to the pits, and that was the last time I drove a race car. Was that Milt Bowl?
You were at a racetrack.
Yeah, that was the last time I was at a racetrack until this year. Yep, you're absolutely right. Yep, and we were in contention to win that race. Actually, I think we qualified outside pole for that Milt Bowl. So we had a very fast car, and I got taken out, but I think that was my fault, that incident. Maybe a little too aggressive.
I guess it makes a little bit of sense then why you would, you know, if you're already thinking this is the end of the line for me, and that's the plan, it's the last race, and you wreck out of it when you've got a good car.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it for me. Yep. Right. Like, see ya.
Yeah. I knew that was going to be my last race, and I really wanted to win the Milt Bowl to go out as a Milt Bowl champion. That would have been awesome. Mm. So that was my goal. And I was running pretty hard. Maybe I should have been a little more reserved or a little more patient, as my dad would say. But yeah, didn't work out for me.
Yeah, gotcha.
Did any of the other drivers kind of know your plan, or did you just kind of become a ghost after that Milt Bowl that no one ever saw or heard from?
Yeah, pretty much became a ghost. Yeah, I pretty much, that's a good way of putting it. I became a ghost. I stayed away from it, sold all our stuff. So I didn't miss it at first. I miss it more now than I did then, especially after going back to the track this summer and stuff. I miss it. I do miss it for sure.
One of my favorite people in the world, and I also was a Hazen kid, played basketball, graduated in 2004, which is somewhat hard to believe for some. With my gray hair and baldness. But one of my favorite people in the world was Dave Morris. And whenever I get a chance to talk about him, I go out of my way to do so. And we have our basketball podcast that just got going. And we had a great Dave Morris story from Aaron Hill. Tell me a little bit about, you know, because Dave was synonymous with, if you're a Hazen guy or a kid, and not just Hazen, anywhere from that area, you know, if he could build you up, he would make you a bigger star than you could ever imagine or ever could be.
You're absolutely right. Dave Morse was awesome to me and my family. He would go to the races with us. He wrote articles on us every week, whether we crashed, we won, no matter. He was awesome. I mean, he wrote some of the best articles, for us and all the local racers in our area, from Wolcott and the surrounding area. But yeah, definitely Dave Morris was a huge, we called him Billy Believers back then. He was really, really good to us. He loved our family. He traveled with us. I mean, he went to Oxford with us. Dave Morris was one of the guys for 3 or 4 years, back in them days. He was part of the family, I should say. Yeah, love him and miss him. He was awesome.
I loved Dave too, and I used to hang out with him in the press boxes and listen to his old war stories of the coupes in the 60s and stuff. And now that I do a lot of research, I found that his articles in like the Hardwick Gazette have been really helpful for me in some ways.
Oh, cool.
But in others, it's really frustrating because I'll search, you know, Riverside Speedway, or I'll search Billy Holbrook, and there's this big article about you and Henry Cleveland every week.
Oh, Henry Cleveland.
You're both finished like eighth or something, and there's no mention of the winners. Exactly. There's no mention of anything that happened except you.
Yep.
So it's like, damn it, this great article that has no information.
Yeah, end, I finished eighth.
Yeah,
but he built it up like I was going to win it, or Henry and I were going to win it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep. Yeah. It's pretty special.
What a guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yep. Need more of him we around. They're not, they don't make them like that anymore.
Oh, not at all. Yeah. He's missed.
Time for our Barry Tile quick hitters, and then we'll let you go. And first up, who did you learn the most from by racing with? In terms of looking out the windshield, you learned more about driving from watching them go.
That's another good question. Well, I probably can't pick just one, but a Chuck Beatty, a Joey LeCaire, Jim Silly, Dwayne Lanfear. I mean, probably learned a lot from them guys. Up in Oxford, Tracy Gordon. I mean, he was a guy up there. And but yeah, I'd probably say them guys. And my dad too. I watched him race for years also. So I got to throw him in the mix too.
Did you ever get a chance to race with your dad, or did you take his car and that was it? Yeah.
Oh, never actually was on the same track. We raced the year I was in a street stocker or quarter of the year or half a year I was in a street stocker. He was racing a late model at Riverside. So when he saw the potential in me, he got out and I got in his late model. So I never actually got to race against him, which would have been cool if we could, for sure. Gotcha. For sure. Yeah.
What is the dumbest thing you ever did in a race car?
Oh, jeez. That's a good question too. The dumbest thing I ever did in a race car. I'm gonna be honest, I can't think of anything. Not say there weren't any, but can't think of anything off the top of my head.
That's good. Selective memory is a good thing to have sometimes.
Yeah, right. Probably when we're done here, I'll think of 10 of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a race that keeps you up at night a little bit more than others, that if you could run it one more time, a mistake you could fix, just one more pass you could make that you want to redo?
Yep, that would be that, my last milk ball. I mean, I was on my way to win that thing, and if I would have been a little more patient, I almost believe I would have won that milk ball, my last race. And if I would have just been a little more patient, I wish I could run that race over with a little more patience, for sure. That would be the one race right there. I think of that quite often. That was my one shot to win the milk bowl.
It sounds like you're not bitter about it, though. It sounds like you've had the time to absorb it and all. But like, I would think that a guy who is knowing it's his last race has a chance to win and wrecks out because of something that you're admitting to. You know, you took yourself across Kendall LeJean's nose and wrecked yourself. It doesn't sound like you have hard feelings about that.
Not at all.
Which is relieving to hear.
Yeah, no, I ain't got no hard feelings at all. I know that day was definitely my fault. I mean, I was pumped up for that race, and again, I needed to be more patient, and I weren't patient in the race car that day at all. And again, if I was, I believe I would have won that milk bowl. The car was just as fast that day as it was in the Coca-Cola 144 that we won. And I just blew it because of my patience.
If you could run anybody else's car for a day, either then or maybe even now, since we've tinkered with the idea, whose car would you have liked to get in?
Probably any Dale Shaw car. If I could get in a Dale Shaw car just for one evening at Thunder Road, that would probably be one of the cars I would pick. Yep. I mean, you know, Dale Shaw cars are good ones. And if I could get in that, I almost think maybe I could do something with it.
I got a feeling it wouldn't be just for one night, though.
Yeah, I know. If I got in a Dale Shaw car, I probably wouldn't want to get out of it. Yeah.
Well, now that we've poked the beehive, I hope to see your name on a roster in the next couple of years.
Oh, that would be awesome. I would like that myself. So maybe put my name out there.
All right. There it is.
Yeah.
We try to do that every week.
If I could go with my helmet and my bag, that would be pretty exciting stuff for me, for sure.
Fecto told us last week he's going to go dirt racing with Steve Miller. So
is that right?
There you go.
Yeah, maybe I'll hook up with Fecto.
There you go.
Work something out. Perfect. Yeah.
With that,
if you were to come back, would that be your dad hadn't passed before you retired, right? So that would be your first ever time going to the track without him?
Yeah, it would be. My dad passed 3 years ago due to a motorcycle accident. So that was part of the reason why it was pretty emotional for me to go back to Thunder Road this year. And I did too. I pictured him down there in that winner's circle at that Coca-Cola 144 with tears in his eyes, which was pretty emotional for me and my brother Sean and my wife that was sitting with me. So it was, it would be the first time I got in a race car without my dad there, which would be very strange, to be honest. Yeah. But I knew, I know he would be liking it as much as I would be, for sure.
The pictures from that night are pretty spectacular. I've seen them on, you know, Alan Ward is a good friend of ours, and they're on that website. And
awesome.
Very, yeah. Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a huge night for us. Big night. I didn't sleep that night. I didn't know if I slept that whole week. It meant that much to my whole family. Yeah. It's huge.
Okay. Do it again then.
Yeah. Right. I'd love to. Yeah.
All right, man. It's a treat to get to know you a little bit, and we've been wondering about you, I guess, and what you're up to. So thanks for joining us and kind of letting us in.
Well, I greatly appreciate the invite to do this. It was nice to talk about the good old days, as I say, and I really, really enjoyed it. I appreciate it for sure.
All right, it's Billy Holbrook.
That was a fun one, and like we mentioned in the open, Justin, we were curious what happened, you know, came and gone in what seems like a short period of time, but then you take into account how early he started, and it was still almost a decade of racing, but to know at 26, I'm burnt out, and this is probably the end, and stick to it. I don't know a lot of people that we've met, yourself included, that can fully just walk away at that type of age and never come back.
Yeah, I still haven't fully walked away as we record a racing podcast.
Right.
Among other projects. The thing that I couldn't believe was that he hadn't been to a racetrack in 25 years, whatever the math is. That's wild.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is cold turkey. I'm done with this. It's not in my life.
Yeah. A lot of people, and obviously I dive into a lot of different sports, but you listen to podcasts or read books. Kids, they were these things that had paper. Sometimes they were hard on the outside. And you had to turn the pages themselves. You didn't swipe from the tablet.
Weird. You got information from them.
Crazy. A lot of athletes, it's interesting. Some, when they retire, immediately go into doing something else in that sport to kind of fill the hole. You know, get into coaching, work in a front office, just do kind of PR, be an ambassador for the team. Yeah. But there's quite a few you listen to that said, I just had to get completely away from it. I couldn't be near me, or it was going to drive me nuts that I wasn't doing it.
I think I understand that too. Like, when you do something and you are totally immersed in it and you love it and you're good at it, and then you feel the need to stop doing it, it's like bringing a drug addict to a crack house, right? And saying, no, you just sit there. You don't do it. You watch us do it.
Yeah. It's like a divorce.
Yeah.
If you're still hanging around canoodling with your ex, you're probably not, it's probably not a clean break at that point.
Right. Yeah. I clearly, like you said, I can't walk away. It's a very interesting commitment.
That could be an interesting, I don't know. We should mark down this topic for something.
Yeah.
For what? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But for something. Merch, you can still get at us on all this. Hey.
Look at that.
Went ahead and got decals as well.
Got some decals, man. Yep. Whole bunch of them.
Much like Justin mentioned in this interview, in terms of coming back to racing, and it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. That's what Justin does. He shows me things. He's like, hey, this looks nice, right? You're going to just add it to our bill when you make out that check.
Write that check, Tom.
But he's smart enough. He shows me. I'm like, ooh, that looks super cool. Yeah. Awesome. Because I got 200 of them.
I did. I got 200 of them. Not of those, 200 total. But we've got decals.
Yeah. At this point, we do not guarantee merch by Christmas.
No, it won't happen. Any new orders will be after the holidays, probably more like February, March. Yep, for sure. But we're moving a lot of merch this coming week, a lot.
Yeah, and we're going to look after the holidays and the start of the year and kind of building some kind of site to house everything. To make things a little easier on, well, Justin, for one, as we do all our business kind of by hand, spreadsheets and all that. And we got a big rush of the holidays, which we were hoping for, which we got, which we are incredibly thankful for. But with that comes a lot of stress to make sure we didn't miss anything or miss anybody who asked for something, purchased something, when it's all kind of in Facebook messages and posts and the DMs.
Like, in fact, literally, because you are saying this, I just remembered that I haven't plugged in the information for our last two orders yet. So I need to do that tonight before I forget. We need to streamline on our back end and make it, I'm sure it'll be easier for you folks, with a site that you can order through and just kind of a one-stop thing rather than messages back and forth or emails or whatever.
Yeah. So check us out, Tinder.com/uncommon deeds.
Oh, I thought we were going with Bumble.
Well, you know, trying to appeal to the young kids.
Yeah.
Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, like the podcast, do all those things. If you can rate it. It helps us with algorithms. It helps us when we show the numbers to potential sponsors who are interested in being a part of this crazy, crazy family. And if you could hear the full versions of today's open and close, you would know how crazy we are. But if you do want to be a part of that family, uncommonmediavt@gmail.com. You can be a part of this show, the No Fouls podcast, which is getting rolling. Episode 3 comes out this week with Uta Otley, the longtime coach at CVU, who just created an absolute dynasty with the Red Hawks girls basketball program. And she has a great story, going all the way back to being a player of the year in Indiana in 1986, like peak Larry Bird, Bobby Knight, Indiana Hoosiers. Indiana basketball was the thing. And tearing her knee in 1986 and what it took to try to come back from that. And all the way through coaching, I was really excited because I hadn't really talked to her much before ever, and it was a great conversation. I'm super excited for everybody to listen to that.
Wednesday. Yeah.
Make sure you're following us on all the socials, Uncommon Deeds on Twitter and Facebook, Uncommon Deeds Podcast on the Instagram.
the Instagram. I have a sore throat.
Yes, he does. That wraps up today's show. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to the Uncommon Deeds podcast, a production of Uncommon Media.